Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour. This is David Corey, along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us. Richard, good evening.
Good evening, David, and hello to everyone out there in listening land. Good evening, everyone. Tonight we have lots of VA news and other topics of interest to veterans. If you have a question or comment, call us now or during the rest of the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, that's 1-888-627-6008. Remember, this is your show, the Veteran News Hour. So call in and let us know how you feel about what's going on in the VA.
Thanks, Richard. And here's our agenda for tonight, everyone. First, we're going to discuss some developments this past week in Congress that affect the VA. Next, we will talk about some highlights of the goals and legislative priorities of some of the country's major veteran groups. Then we'll have our Veterans History segment, and then wrap up with our regular segment called Hurley's Tips, in which Richard Hurley offers some practical words of wisdom for veterans dealing with the VA.
Sounds like a full slate tonight. But first, we want to look in this in Washington this past week. The House Committee on Veteran Affairs passed five pieces of legislation, which we will discuss this evening. The bills now go to the full House for a vote, and then we'll move to the Senate for action. In prior week's shows, we discussed some proposed legislation that combined two separate goals, giving the VA Secretary more power to hold VA employees accountable, and also reforming the disability appeals system. This past week, the House committee took action on the first of those goals by passing a bill, H.R. 1259. It is now clear that the House committee is separating those two goals, which we think is a good idea since the ideas to reform the disability appeals system are very flawed, in our opinion.
Now, Richard, of the five bills passed by the committee, as you said, one is H.R. 1259. H.R. 1259 is called the VA Accountability First Act of 2017. It was introduced by House Committee Chairman Phil Rowe, who happens to be a medical doctor, well as a congressman, and that bill would provide the VA secretary with increased flexibility to remove, demote, or suspend any VA employee, including senior executive service employees, for performance problems or misconduct. The committee's press release this past week states as follows, and I quote, "We've all heard stories about employees at the Department of Veteran Affairs who fail in their duties to serve veterans. While the vast majority of VA employees are hardworking and dedicated, because VA often fails to hold individuals who are not fulfilling their duties accountable for their actions, these bad actors taint the reputation of the department as a whole. In instances where VA has tried to take disciplinary action against an employee, the process is so administratively complex and lengthy that such an action can take more than a year and oftentimes being delayed indefinitely. A recent study completed by the U.S. Government Accountability Office found that on average it takes 6 months to a year to remove a permanent civil servant in the federal government, though it often takes much longer than that. And just this past year, former VA Deputy Secretary Sloan Gibson testified at a congressional hearing that it was too hard to fire bad employees at the VA. So in the past several years, the VA's arcane civil service rules have hampered the department's ability to dismiss an employee that engaged in an armed robbery. That's just one example. In another case, to discipline a nurse who participated in a veteran's operation while she was intoxicated. And in another case, to hold employees accountable for the continued failures to manage several major construction projects, including the new hospital in Aurora, Colorado, which is now several years overdue and $1 billion over budget. We discussed that case in one of our earlier weeks on this show. Now, this VA Accountability First Act of 2017 would provide the VA secretary with increased flexibility to remove, demote, or suspend any VA employee, including, as I said, senior executive service employees, for performance or misconduct problems. It would also provide improved protection for whistleblowers. It would allow the VA to reduce an employee's federal pension if they are convicted of a felony that influenced their job at the VA, to recoup a bonus provided to an employee who engaged in misconduct or poor performance prior to receiving the bonus. And the bill would allow the secretary to recoup any relocation expenses that were authorized by a VA employee only through the employee's ill-gotten means, such as fraud, waste, or malfeasance. So it's an important bill.
Yeah, you know, David, that's a mouthful for sure. You know, we have several of our clients are actual VA employees, and in previous weeks we've discussed how they've shared with me. You know, the problem is this stuff all comes from the top down. So
right.
Hopefully the secretary is going to take action at the top and set an example by start working down so that the regional offices will also do the same thing. But, you know, the proof is in the pudding. We'll see what happens.
Well, I agree. I think this bill, if it becomes law, it's just more power that the VA secretary has to clean house. So the VA secretary, the new one that we have, David Shulkin, will really have no excuse for not doing that. They can no longer just blame employees that they can't fire. But there's certainly a lot of room for improvement in this VA.
You know, David, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't former Secretary McDonald given some leeway too to remove employees?
He was, and I think you had some. Conversations with, as I recall you telling me, with the congressman in your area about how Congress was pretty disappointed that Bob McDonald really had not used the power they had given him. So it does require leadership, and hopefully Secretary Shulkin is going to use this opportunity.
We're going to watch that one. And the second of the five bills, David, is H.R. 369. This is the eliminating the sunset date of the Choice Act, which would eliminate the statutory sunset date for the Choice program and instead allow the program to continue until the original funding has been expended. This will enable some veterans to get medical care outside the VA in certain circumstances. The Veterans Access Choice and Accountability Act, also known as the Choice Act, established the Veteran Choice Program. The Choice Act included language to state that the Department of Veteran Affairs is authorized to continue services until August 7, 2017, or until the funds provided under the Choice Act ran out, whichever occurred first. While the authorization is set to expire on August 7, 2017, the VA has informed Congress that there still will be funds remaining in the Veterans Choice Program after August 7th, meaning veterans could still access health care services under the Choice Act if Congress eliminates the sunset date. Should Congress eliminate the sunset date of the Veterans Choice Program, veterans utilizing the program can continue seeking care outside the VA under this authority, paid for with funds that have already been appropriated. While Congress continues to pursue VA reform, the VA Deputy Secretary Sloan Gibson sent a letter requesting Congress eliminate the sunset date last December.
And the third bill that was passed by the House Veteran Affairs Committee this past week is H.R. 1181. It's the Veterans Second Amendment Protection Act. We had talked about this bill in prior week shows, and this was another bill introduced by the chairman of the committee, Phil Rowe. The background to this law is pretty simple, actually, and Richard and I, we've had clients that have fallen in this category where veteran with, let's say, some psychological disabilities, is evaluated by a VA psychologist or psychiatrist who is asked a question in their standard checklist of questions whether that veteran is capable of managing his or her own funds. And by simply checking no, that the veteran is not so capable, that sets into motion some processes that result in the veteran often having a fiduciary or independent third party appointed by the VA to manage his or her own funds. And it also has a collateral effect, which can result in the veteran losing the right to legally purchase or own a firearm. So that's the background to this bill, H.R. 1181, which was passed by a committee, so it will now go to the full House for the vote. This bill would prohibit the VA from considering any beneficiary who's assisted by a fiduciary as, quote, mentally defective without a magistrate or judicial authority ruling that the beneficiary is a danger to themselves or others. Under the current practice, as I said, when a veteran or beneficiary is appointed a fiduciary, they're labeled mentally incompetent in the VA system, and then the VA automatically sends that person's name to the FBI for inclusion in their background check system, which can result in that person being unable to legally purchase or own a firearm. And again, we're talking about people who have, while they may have psychological impairments, they are not necessarily a threat to themselves or to others. And as a result, the purpose of this law is simply to make sure that that there's a magistrate or some other judicial authority, not just some VA employee, who makes the determination of whether the veteran's Second Amendment rights will be protected or not. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with this law, but it's another one that passed the committee this past week.
And the fourth bill to discuss tonight is H.R. 1367, 1367, to improve the authority of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to hire and retain physicians and other employees of the Department of Veterans Affairs. It would establish a recruiting database to make high-quality potential employees aware of positions at the VA and create opportunities for career training and advancement for current VA employees through fellowship positions and a promotional track for technical experts. Providing the top-notch health care and benefits our nation's veterans deserve is impossible without a strong workforce. And veterans and VA's inability to retain high-quality employees is hindering the quality of care veterans receive. A 2016 Best Places to Work survey ranked the Department of Veterans Affairs second to last for large agencies overall, second to last in effective leadership, and dead last in pay. And, you know, David, we're supposed to be taking care of our veterans, and we have this type of poor performance.
With a lot of turnover, I might add, too, at the VA. We both observed that.
Yeah.
As well.
You know, the survey also found that the number of VA employees resigning or retiring has risen every year since 2009. This bill would establish staffing, recruitment, retention programs to enable VA to recruit and retain the very best in the field. This bill would establish a recruiting database to make high-quality potential employees aware of positions at the VA and create opportunities for career training and advancement for current VA employees through fellowship positions and a promotional track for technical experts. This legislation would also require VA to measure and collect certain information regarding hiring effectiveness and train human resource employees in recruitment and retention methods. You know, David, these same clients that we have at the VA were telling me about one of the things that they experienced is the fact that there is no advancement within the VA that they see, and with the different people that they work with, to the point where, you know, so many of them get bored. You know, they might get a slight pay raise, but they're really looking to to get more involved, get their hands in some stuff, and use their brain and be a little creative. And
right.
So many of them just seem to end up having to push the same buttons every day. For a month, you know, into a year, and eventually, you know, they don't care. And I think that's what then rolls over into their attitude toward the veteran. You know,
right.
if they're not happy, how are they going to make a veteran coming in there looking for assistance happy?
Right.
So hopefully,
and I think what you mentioned earlier about that Best Places to Work survey that last year ranked the VA as second to the last overall as really the worst place to work of large government agencies, that's really telling. There's a culture. There needs to be a culture shift, and they need leadership, and not just from Secretary Shulkin, but through many different levels, to kind of change that culture that that is causing so many VA employees, as you say, to just to feel like they're just going to stagnate in a particular job. They don't feel like there's opportunities to be promoted or rewarded for their efforts. And as a result, I mean, our own observations when we visited the regional office, which is frequently, is there just seems to be, just as one example, the customer service area, just a tremendous lack of any sense of urgency or any real effort to help. It's like the people are just going through the motions when you ask for assistance and they're checking the computer for information. They're doing the absolute minimum, it seems, just to get you out of the office. And it's not as if that they're so overwhelmed with work that they can't take the extra 5 minutes. So there does need to be a culture change. It's not going to happen overnight, but that's something hopefully these various bills that we've just talked about will help that.
They need to work on those coffee breaks that you and I go off
right.
<and deserve.
laughs> Right. Now, let me just remind, before talking about this fifth bill, let me remind our listeners, we certainly welcome your viewpoint, your thoughts on these bills. Our call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. Again, that's 1-888-627-6008. We'd love to hear from you tonight. The fifth bill that the House Committee on Veteran Affairs reported, which would go to the full House for a vote, is H.R. 1379. It's pretty short and to the point. It's basically to provide entitlement to educational assistance under the post-9/11 educational assistance program to expand it to include members of the armed forces who have been awarded the Purple Heart for being wounded. All right, those are the five bills, and we're going to track those.
excuse me. They next go to the full House for a vote, and then the Senate, then after that to the President for a signature or veto. But we'll keep listeners updated in future shows, and we'll be following steps taken by the two committees, and we'll be reporting on those events in our future shows. Meanwhile, we urge listeners to pay attention to what is going on in Congress, because it will affect current veterans as well as future veterans. Thanks to the Internet, it's relatively easy to monitor Congress. Check out the websites for the two committees at veterans.house.gov and veterans.senate.gov. Another valuable way to track pending legislation is through the website www.govtrack.us. You know, David, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen these town hall on the news where so many people were irate, and most of those issues were over the Affordable Care Act. But wouldn't it be great if, you know, we took a guy like Congressman Bill Arrakis and had a town, and by the way, for our listeners, Congressman Bill Arrakis here in Florida is the number two man on the Veterans Committee, so he would be an appropriate person to have at a town hall with a room, you know, stacked and packed with veterans. You know, fully, you know, armed with enough information to really kind of put Congressman Bill Arrakis on the spot, you know, because I think that's what we need to do. These veterans, our veterans, they need to get together as a group and voice their concerns as a group. Get out there and vote. You know, in 2 years, we got another election coming up. So, you know, if these people at D.C. aren't taking care of them at this point, vote them out and let's vote some other people in.
Right. Now, and speaking of Congressman Bill Arrakis, and for those of you from other parts of the country, he represents primarily Pasco County, which is just north of St. Petersburg. It's the Tarpon Springs area. It's on the west central coast of Florida, and it's an area, the west coast of Florida, very heavy veteran population, and he's had town halls where he's gotten blasted for the Affordable Care Act issue, and I saw a news release recently where he had a meeting with some veterans, but it was a round table in a conference room. It wasn't a town hall sort of, you know what I mean? So there really wasn't the opportunity for a lot of veterans, and I found out about that after the fact, and you and I have both extended invitations to his office to come to our show, as well as other members of Congress. But, yeah, you really have to – the members of Congress, they have a lot on their plate, to be sure. But you really have to let them know about the impact of this legislation. And Richard, you mentioned several good websites. In this information age we live in, it's really information overload. I subscribe to so many free email newsletter services from the congressional committees that you've talked about, to many veteran groups that will, some of them will put out daily email newsletters. This website that you gave, which is www.govtrack.us, which is govtrack.us, is a great website. I subscribe to email updates for various members of Congress, for members of committee, and you can also subscribe to follow specific bills in Congress. And they'll consolidate all your subscriptions into one email every day. It's just a wonderful free service. So there's no excuse for people nowadays to say, well, I can't find this information. You know, you and I, Richard, we've been practicing law since the mid-'80s, long before the Internet as we know it. And we both know how tough it was, even though Lexis and Westlaw, these other services existed in the 80s, and nothing like it does today, nothing like the information that we get for free on the Internet. It was so much tougher then to track what was going on. Now it's so easy, there's no excuse not to. But we're trying to make it easy on this show by highlighting things. But in our, you know, 55 minutes every week, we don't have enough time to cover everything. So we invite listeners to call in and share their thoughts. And we also, to kind of keep a cast a broad net out there on what's going on, what's of interest, we also track what many veteran groups are doing. And as I reported in previous week shows, the last few weeks and even periodically through the end of this month, there have been and will be hearings before the House committee and the Senate committee from various veteran groups who are expressing their viewpoints. And Richard, as you said earlier, it's important for veterans to pay attention. I completely agree, because so many veterans just very understandably, they put kind of blind faith in these big veteran groups like the American Legion and the VFW, Veterans of the Foreign Wars, and Disabled American Veterans groups, that they're going to be looking out for their interests. And I don't think that's always the case. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I can tell you the bottom line, it doesn't always work that way. But I've been tracking what these groups have been telling Congress, and we'll continue to do so. Now, in addition to the legislation that we've just talked about, another issue that's affecting literally hundreds of thousands of veterans was discussed in Congress this past week. There was a press release from March 7th this past week when leadership from both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House committees on Veterans Affairs were calling upon Secretary Shulkin to extend VA health care enrollment opportunities after a VA computer coding error reportedly resulted in the incorrect closure of up to 440,000 applications by veterans for VA health care services. So potentially up to 440,000 veterans were affected by having their applications incorrectly closed due to this error. So congressional committee leadership sent a letter to Secretary Shulkin asking him to please make sure that the VA contacts these veterans who were potentially impacted to let them know what information they need so their applications for health care can be processed. And hopefully this clarifying letter will let veterans know that they do, you know, are still being considered and what information the VA needs from them to complete their enrollment. If you're out there and you're a veteran that's been affected by this, give us a call. Share your experience. But there's also a toll-free number that the VA has if you have health care enrollment questions. And let me give you that number. That's the VA number. It's 1-877-222-VETS. VETS. So that's 1-877-222-VETS, which translates in numerically into 8387. That's a toll-free number you can call the VA for assistance if you've applied to enroll in the VA healthcare system. Like I say, potentially over 400,000 veterans have been affected by this error, and Congress is aware of it. The VA is aware of it. The question will be how soon can they remedy that. So another important issue. It's very timely. And hope veterans will follow that. We'll keep you posted.
Well, that's all good information, good stuff there, David. Thank you very much. You know, another big development occurred this Tuesday, March 7th, when VA Secretary Shulkin announced his intention to expand provisions for urgent mental health care needs to former service members with other than honorable OTH administrative discharges. This move marks the first time a VA secretary has implemented an initiative specifically focused on expanding access to assist former OTH service members who are in mental health distress and may be at risk for suicide or other adverse behaviors, Secretary Shulkin stated. The President and I have made it clear that suicide prevention is one of our top priorities. We know the rate of death by suicide among veterans who do not use VA care is increasing at a greater rate than veterans who use VA care. This is a national emergency that requires bold action. We must and we will do all that we can to help former service members who may be at risk. When we say even one veteran suicide is one too many, we mean it. According to a VA press release dated March 8th, it is estimated that there are a little more than 500,000 former service members with OTH discharges. As part of the proposal, former OTH service members who would be able to seek treatment at a VA emergency department, vet center, or contact the Veterans Crisis Line. Dr. Shulkin also stated, our goal is simple, to save lives. Veterans who are in crisis should receive help immediately. Far too many veterans have fallen victim to suicide, roughly 20 every day. Far too many families are left behind asking themselves what more could have been done. The time for action is now. According to the VA press release, before finalizing the plan in early summer, Secretary Shulkin will meet with Congress, veteran service organizations, and Department of Defense officials to determine the best way forward to get these former service members the care they need. Now let's move on to our next segment tonight about some of the goals and priorities of some nation's major veterans groups, which testified before Congress in the past couple of weeks. David, I believe you have some good information for us.
Yeah, I do. I've been tracking those as they've testified before Congress, and I want to start with the views of the American Legion. It's one of the biggest veteran groups in the country. And in the American Legion's presentation to congressional committees on March 1st, it discussed many issues, including the many problems with the current disability appeal system. Richard, you and I have talked about this issue every week for the last month about how backlogged the appeal system is. When a claim is denied or there's a low rating, the veteran can spend 4, 5, 6, or 10 years appealing, trying to get a favorable decision. Terrific wait. Everyone knows that. This is not new, but here's the VA's the American Legion's position on what the VA should do. The American Legion basically supports the legislation that was passed by the House in 2016, but which failed in the Senate. That legislation would completely revamp the appeals options for veterans. It would purport to provide faster tracks if veterans waive their hearings, which I think, Richard, you and I would probably agree that that itself is a red flag, because we find these hearings a very important part in successfully winning a case, not just relying on the paper, but to actually have a face-to-face hearing. But the things that, you know, and I know you're going to talk about this, but basically the American Legion took the position that they're going to specifically endorse a bill called H.R. 457, which has been introduced in the House by Representative Dina Titus, of Nevada. Richard, I know you're going to tell us more about that particular bill.
Yeah, as you said, David, that's endorsed by the American Legion. That's Bill H.R. 457. Contains the identical wording found in another bill, H.R. 611, which we have discussed on prior shows. We are very concerned about both bills. Both bills would end the VA's current legal duty to assist veterans in developing their claims after the VA makes its first decision on the case. Currently, that duty to assist exists both in the initial claim development as well as through the BVA appeal stage. But this proposed law would eliminate that duty after the VA makes its first decision. That's a very bad idea, veterans. Let's let your voices be heard to Congress on this one. You know, this is one of those issues I would love to get Congressman Bill Arrakis in a room with about 1,000 veterans and let them voice their concern about that.
Absolutely.
The VA, you know,
yeah.
But the VA, first of all, does a pretty shabby job in assisting veterans, as we well know. You know, I had a veteran in today, and we were talking about that duty to assist. And, you know, he said to me, when he walked to the regional office down there in St. Petersburg, he feels like there's a big wall in front of him and that he can't even get in. You know, and so generally speaking, while there's this duty to assist, I think, David, you and I have seen that essentially this is becoming an adversarial process. And it's
right.
A process. It's an adversarial process from the start, because these veterans, as you know, David, you know, go up there for their initial meeting, as far as they're concerned, and they get there, and all they hear is no, 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 and these guys and gals, they walk away thinking that there's nothing they can do, and there's no support, and that law would only get worse if this part of the law is passed, because the VA will have little incentive to do any better than it does now. And it won't have to do anything to help veterans develop their claims and gather evidence after the initial decision. I don't think they do anything anyway.
Right.
Another very bad idea in this bill is that it would eliminate the duty of a decision review officer, also called HRO, DRO, to accept new evidence and instead would base a decision only on the record as it exists, which is usually poorly developed in the first place due to a combination of the VA not assisting the veteran and most veteran service officers putting too much faith in the VA rather than building a strong case for the veterans they help. I urge listeners, again, to contact their representatives in the House and their two U.S. senators to voice their concern and hopefully their opposition to attempts to overhaul the appeal system with the complicated mess offered by H.R. 457, despite its endorsement by the American Legion. In my opinion, the disability appeal system is broken because the VA has failed to hire enough decision review officers and enough lawyers and judges for the Board of Veterans Appeals. David, you and I have talked about this before. In St. Petersburg, there are about 28 or 30 decision review officers, and there's approximately 30,000 cases pending.
Right.
Which is, you know, unbelievable when you think they have to handle 1,000
right.
cases. And it's absurd. You know, it's just absurd. But,
which
you know,
is why it
veterans,
takes 3 to 4 years to get a hearing.
Exactly. You know, veterans, love to hear from you on this issue because this directly affects you today. You know, we don't have to wait for Congress to do anything and wait for these bills to pass. You know, this is an issue that you should be voicing your concern about right now. So I'd love to hear from you. Call us now at 888-627-6008. Again, that's 1-888-627-6008. David, I understand you've got some information about Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Right. I've compiled the viewpoints of several groups, Disabled American Veterans, Paralyzed Veterans of America, and Veterans of Foreign Wars, who supported the same or very similar proposals as you've just described about reforming the disability appeals process. They were part, those three groups, the DAV, Paralyzed Veterans of America, and the VFW, were part of a work team last year that worked up some ideas. I'd like to talk about that more, but Richard, we've got a caller. So, Doug, let's take Jenna on line three, please. Hello.
Good evening. Good
evening. Hello, Jenna.
Hello.
Yes, welcome. How are you tonight?
Well, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
Basically, I just had, I guess, just a comment about the whole appeal process. I am a veteran. I've been in the military for 9 years, and I am dealing with an appeal that's been like 6 years in the making after starting one of my first appeals shortly after I came home from my deployment in 2010. I just finished my second appeal where I had a the video teleconference. I just feel like the VA intentionally tries to make it so difficult for a veteran to even want to appeal because they're so discouraged. Once you apply, you're automatically denied, or they kind of nickel and dime you. They find ways around the system and research kind of how to disregard the whatever you are claiming, whether it be a mental or physical disability. And, or they, when you go in and do your compensation and pension examinations, they either admit or they falsify or they try to downgrade whatever symptoms you're feeling to manipulate the system to try to give you the most minimum amount they can give you. And that is, like myself, very discouraging because you feel like, you know, hey, I am listed in the military, I'm serving my country nobly, I'm injured, and, you know, I just want the help, and I can't even get that. So
right.
Myself, I've been through it. I'm still going through it. It is mentally exhausting. Like, we don't have enough to deal with on a daily basis. It's just kind of, you know.
Well, I think that sums it up well, Jenna, what you've just said about it, you know, as if you don't have you and other disabled veterans, injured veterans, it's not as if you don't have enough to deal with already, and then you've got this VA, which should be a user-friendly, they should be helping you, basically. Like you say, you served your country honorably, you served deployments overseas in a war zone, you come home injured, and the VA should be helping you instead of being so adversarial about it. But what you've described is something that Richard Hurley and I have seen time and time again, where if they don't deny the claim for whatever reason, then they'll issue an unfairly low rating, which translates into a lot less money, and the veteran needs this money to often just to pay bills every month.
That's understandable, but for me, it's not necessarily the monetary amount. It's like the moral of it. Like, hey, I have all these debilitating issues, and the VA wants to try to downplay it like I'm perfectly normal because everybody's different. They've been through a lot.
Right.
And I feel like they're just looking at me from a paperwork standpoint. They're not looking at the whole picture and who I am. You know, I'm a single mother of like an almost 3-year-old, and it gets very aggravating for me. Like last month I had to go to do my appeal. I have to like basically state my whole case, you know, tell them what I'm about, what's going on. And it just feels like you're pleading a case. I don't feel like that should have to be.
Right.
They're not looking at the person. They're just looking at the paperwork, and they don't know what that veteran's going through every day.
Right. And I think that's why having face-to-face or video conference hearings are so important, because it helps the VA to realize they're dealing with people and not just a file of papers and documents. So, Jenna, what advice would you care to share with other listeners, other veterans out there, maybe based on your experience?
My biggest advice is just do not give up. Like, I've been fighting this fight for quite a long time, and I'm very stubborn, and I am a client of Mr. Hurley's, but without his help, I would have given up a long time ago, just because I felt like doing it on my own, I just wasn't good enough, or I would never win. And it was like a battle that I just was exhausted. I just couldn't do it anymore. But my biggest advice is just don't give up. That's what the VA wants you to do. They want to shut you down. You just need to be a voice for yourself. And if you can't do it on your own, you need to seek help, because you're not going to, you know, reap the reward unless you go through, you know, the fight of it. So.
Right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your views and for calling in tonight. And
thanks for calling in, Jenna.
And thank you.
Thanks again. Thank you. I think that kind of
sums it up, huh, David?
Absolutely. I mean, the perseverance that she has described is absolutely important with the VA, because, you know, we've already, and Jenna has already seen years and years of appeals, waiting time to get a hearing. We see that, and then we're faced with the director of the St. Pete regional office, one of the busiest regional offices in the entire country because of the Florida veterans population being so large, that she had a town hall meeting about a month ago, and she predicted unless changes weren't made in the appeal system that what might be a 4 to 5 year wait typically on appeals might extend up to 10 years, which is totally absurd. I think it's just, you know, to me, the VA has enough intelligent people that I can only interpret that what they're doing is an intentional thing to the point of having malice, that they would enable such a system, such a broken system, to continue. I mean, I served in the military for many years. If you were in the military, today's military and the military I was in from the 80s on for about 20 years, including the reserve duty, I worked with a lot of organizations, different commands within the Air Force, and this sort of incompetence and bad management you see in the VA would absolutely never have been tolerated in the military. People would have been fired. They would have been reassigned. And in the Air Force, we often had, whenever there was a big problem that needed immediate attention, there would be teams. Sometimes they'd call them tiger teams, with very focused on a particular problem to develop a solution and fix it. Because, that sense of urgency, which you particularly see in wartime, is absolutely needed. And there's no sense of urgency in the VA. So, Richard, when you said there's 30 or less decision review officers at the St. Pete regional office, that's out of about 900 employees that work at that regional office, which to me, they need to reallocate their personnel and make a focused effort to get rid of that 30,000 case backlog. And to do a better job. The other problem that we've seen, Richard, in many cases of the decision review officers, many of them, you wait years to get a hearing with them, and then if there's any tough issue at all, anything that requires their judgment or interpretation of evidence, what do? They punt. They punt it to the next level. They make the veteran appeal it to the Board of Veterans Appeals, which is another 3 or 4 year wait.
David, on that note, not only do they punt, but they tell me and they tell the veteran at the hearing, they concede that we will probably be successful at the BVA, and probably, they could render that same decision at their level. However, like you just said, they punt because, for whatever reason, they feel that they'd rather have the BVA make that decision than themselves.
And I think when you say for whatever reason, I think there are various reasons, perhaps. But one I think was summed up well by a whistleblower from the St. Pete office that I know you've talked about in previous shows, who basically testified that there was pressure within the VA, basically, to make veterans fight for what compensation they were going to get, recognizing they may eventually win, and it's truly, truly misguided. And in some ways, you could say it's malicious. So
I think his exact testimony was, "We don't mind paying the veteran, but they're going to work for him."
Yeah, and that's just totally wrong. Yeah, Richard, I know
one of my. When one of my Vietnam veterans said to me years ago, he thought Vietnam was going to be tough. He never realized that it would be even tougher dealing with his own government.
Right, right. Now, I know we're our hour here is moving along pretty quickly. So let me move on and touch on very briefly a proposal by the American Legion, Richard, and then let's move on to our history segment. The American Legion. Has proposed to Congress that they need to strengthen veterans' educational benefits. To be specific, there's an inequity between veterans' GI educational benefits and other for traditional non-veteran students. And this inequity became very apparent just in the last year. Many of you may have heard of the institution, ITT Technical Institute, an educational company. Well, they abruptly shut down 130 of its campuses in 2016, affecting more than 40,000 students. And of those 40,000, 70, 7,000 were veterans who had used their GI Bill educational benefits to attend that school. And what the American Legion wants Congress to do is to change the law so that veterans have the same rights as non-veterans, which is that in certain circumstances to have their student loans discharged whenever the academic institution essentially folds, and that might be through negligence or some other malfeasance. So we'll see if Congress does anything with that. Now, Richard, why don't we move on to our Veterans History segment for tonight.
Yeah, I love my history section and my segment here. Okay, tonight I'd like to highlight and pay tribute to the sacrifices of American service members who served in war and who were captured and held as prisoners of war by the enemy. We selected this topic for one of our March history segments because it was in March, as well as in February of 1973, that American service members held at POWs during the Vietnam War were free and returned to the United States. We thought tonight would be a good time to commemorate the service and sacrifices of those brave Americans who often were tortured and had other forms of maltreatment as POWs. Here are some enlightening statistics gathered by researcher Alan Marsh and published in 1988 on the National Park Service's website for the notorious Andersonville POW camp from the Civil War. The Camp Sumter Military Prison at Andersonville was one of the largest Confederate military prisons during the Civil War. During the 14 months the prison existed, more than 45,000 Union soldiers were confined there. Of these, almost 13,000 died. According to Alan Marsh, in the largest war of the 20th century, World War II, thousands of Americans were held as prisoners of war. In Europe, nearly 94,000 Americans were interned as POWs. Many of these had been shot down while flying missions over Germany or had fought in the Battle of the Bulge. Conditions for POWs worsened as the war drew to a close. Malnutrition, overcrowding, and lack of medical attention was common. As American and Russian forces closed in from opposite directions, many American POWs were taken from camps and forced to march for weeks as the Germans tried to avoid the Allied forces. In the Pacific Theater, nearly 30,000 Americans were interned by the Japanese. Most of these men and women were captured after the fall of the Philippines and suffered some of the highest death rates in American history at nearly 40%. Prisoners of war suffered a brutal captivity, and many were crowded into L ships bound for Japan. Oftentimes, the unmarked ships were torpedoed by submarines. Those POWs who survived internment in the Philippines and the hell ships were forced to work in mines and other locations in Japan. Most worked 7 days a week with minimal food.
Richard, when you mentioned POWs held by the Japanese, when I was on active duty in the Air Force and stationed in England, I had the occasion in about 1989 to attend a reunion of some British World War II veterans who had been, among others, they had been POWs by the Japanese in Southeast Asia. Some of you may have seen the movie The Bridge Over the River Kwai. Well, these were some of those same veterans. They were survivors. And they told me stories of, as you described, these hell ships that they were put on when they were transferred from POW camps in Southeast Asia, moving up to the islands in Japan or close to Japan. And they were sometimes, some of these ships were torpedoed by Allied ships because they didn't know they were full of POWs. But a couple of POWs that I met in prison camps in Japan, they actually saw one of the atomic bomb mushroom clouds in the distance. That would have been August of 1945. But after World War II, you know, just a few years later, we were in Korea, and American prisoners of war during Korea were subjected to absolutely horrendous treatment by the North Koreans. Solitary confinement, forced marching in sub-freezing weather, brutal torture and punishments, and also attempts at political re-education or brainwashing. And that was really one of the first cases where they had systematic attempts at indoctrination by the enemy. There were many Americans who were victims of massacres by the North Koreans, and even today, there's more than 8,000 Americans still listed as MIA, missing in action from the Korean War. And then, of course, Richard, you're going to talk about the Vietnam War.
Yeah, David, 766 Americans are known to have been prisoners of war. Of this number, 114 died during captivity. Unlike previous wars, the length of time as a POW was extensive for many. With some being interned for more than 7 years, torture was common, and the Geneva Convention was not followed. As the North Vietnamese claimed the Americans were political prisoners, political criminals and not prisoners of war. Americans gave nicknames to many of the prisoners of war camps, Alcatraz, the Hanoi Hilton, Briar Patch, the Zoo, Dog Patch, the latter located only 5 miles from the Chinese border. After American forces raided one camp, Son Le Te, the North Vietnamese moved POWs from the countryside of North Vietnam into Hanoi. American POWs were released and returned home as part of the Operation Homecoming in February and March of 1973. I remember seeing that on TV when they were coming off the plane.
Right, yeah, and I'd recommend those that like to study history, there's a lot of YouTube videos on that. And some of the most famous POWs in Vietnam included, as most people know, Senator John McCain, also the late Admiral James Stockdale, who was a Medal of Honor winner in 1992 vice presidential candidate, also the late Senator Jeremiah Denton of Alabama, and the late Colonel George Bud Day, who was awarded both the Congressional Medal of Honor and the Air Force Cross. What's interesting about Bud Day was after his 35-year military career, he became a lawyer, and then he aggressively represented veterans in various legal matters before his death in 2013. March is also the month, back in 1991, I was on active duty at that time, that American POWs from Operation Desert Storm in Iraq were returned to the United States. When I was on active duty, I met two former POWs. One was Colonel Dave Eberle, who was the senior American POW during Operation Desert Storm. He had been a senior officer at the base I was stationed stateside before he deployed. The other POW, former POW I met was then Colonel, later Brigadier General Tom Browning, who spent 6.5 years as a POW in Vietnam, but upon his return was able to continue his Air Force career, eventually promoted to Brigadier General. What's interesting about General Browning was his father had served in World War II as a B-17 navigator and bombardier, and he was shot down over Germany, where he spent 19 months in Stalag 17B as a POW. So tonight, we wish to honor and pay respects to the awesome sacrifices made by all who were POWs while in the service of our nation. That's the goal for our history segment tonight. And I know, Richard, our time is rapidly running out. Maybe if you could just give us a quick 30 seconds on your Hurley's tips, and we can pick those up again next week.
Yeah, I just would like to remind everybody out there that there's a huge number of job vacancies which the VA has, particularly in the healthcare. If you are looking for an opportunity to work in a job helping and serving our nation's veterans, the VA currently has approximately 45,300 vacancies around the country. Go to www.va.gov/jobs for more information. Also, many VA offices around the country periodically hold job fairs that you can attend to help with the process. Please check out the VA's website. Again, the website is www.va.gov/jobs. Go out there and apply for some of these jobs and help our veterans. They sure could use it.
Yep, that's great. And we'll cover more of Hurley's tips next week. I just want to wrap up by reminding everyone that if you know a veteran who's suicidal or in any kind of crisis, the VA does have a crisis line to help. It's 1-800-273-8255, and then press the number 1. I think it's been a great show, Richard. I'm looking forward to next week.
Yep.
We'll be back here next Monday, same time, same station, great BBSRadio.com, Station 1. Thanks to our producer, Doug Newsom, for the great job he's done. And we invite listeners to call us. Our contact information is on our website, BBSRadio.com/the Veterans News Hour. That's our show for tonight. And please tune in next week for another great show.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.